The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled The Dead Sea Scrolls, is the 11th of a 16-part series from Yavna to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Moshe Ben Yosef Olav HaSholem, Mr. Moshe Mizrahi Hod of blessed memory.
Okay. In the spring of 1947, a Bedouin shepherd, while tending his flock near a cliff on the western shore of the Dead Sea, in an area known as Qumran, noticed a cave that he had not seen before. He threw a rock into it, and to his surprise, heard the sound of something breaking. A few days later, he returned with a friend and discovered what was perhaps the greatest archaeological find of the century. Hidden in clay jars and wrapped in linen were ancient Hebrew scrolls written in a script very similar to the one in use today. After originally finding three scrolls, four additional scrolls were eventually recovered from that cave. Eventually, over the next decade, 10 more caves were discovered containing 11 complete or semi-complete scrolls and thousands of fragments belonging originally to almost 800 separate manuscripts. Of these, only some 200 are biblical, part of Tanakh. The rest are either part of the Apocrypha, as that body of literature composed during the period of the Second Temple, considered by the Catholic Church to be canonical, part of their Bible, but is not recognized by the Jews nor by the Protestants. And the Pseudepigrapha, this previously known non-biblical religious compositions, often attributed to ancient authors. And besides those, there were religious works that were previously totally unknown. This last group of previously unknown literature makes up the bulk of the non-biblical discoveries. Who wrote these scrolls? And when were they written? The non-biblical writings reveal the literature and life of a special sect of Jews, very similar to that of the ancient sect of Essenes, a subject we will speak of in a few moments. There are, in addition, striking similarities between this sect, those that wrote much of this literature, and that of the early Christians. Although the major scrolls that were discovered were translated and published shortly after their discovery, the numerous fragments were largely left unpublished by the international team of researchers for over 40 years. Some have claimed that since much of the research was done under the auspices of the École de Biblique, an institution with close ties to the Vatican, there was actually a conspiracy to indefinitely delay publication of these fragments for fear of the negative impact they would have on Christianity. When did they live? Shortly after their discovery, the linen wrappings of the scrolls were dated by carbon-14 testing. Due to the inexactness of the procedure, an exact date could not be determined. The results of the tests give a mean date for the wrappings at approximately 33 of the common era, plus or minus 200 years. I mean, that's the level of discrepancy of the carbon-14 dating. However, based on discoveries of coins dating from before 100 before the common era to approximately the year 135 of the common era, those coins were found in what some seems to be the remnants of the monastery of that sect. These are the ruins of the of that monastery, which is located in an area not far from the caves where the scrolls were discovered. And also based, so one was, one basis was, we said, were the coins found in these ruins. The dating was also based upon the internal evidence of the scrolls. The majority of scholars maintain that the sect started in the beginning of the Maccabee era, in other words, somewhere around the year 160 before the Common Era, 140 before the Common Era, and extended to the destruction of the Second Temple. According to the majority view, at the time of the Second Temple, these people were either killed by the Romans or forsook the sect. The later coins, though, which date after the destruction of the temple, the destruction of the temple was in approximately the year 70 of the Common Era, are attributed to subsequent settlement by Roman soldiers and by members of Bar Kokhba's revolt, unrelated to the first settlement. There are, however, a vocal minority of scholars that maintain that the sect that lived in Qumran near the Dead Sea were in fact early Christians, and their literature is the original literature of the early church. According to their theory, the sect was not destroyed by the Romans. It was, however, eventually overshadowed and superseded by a different form of Christianity created by Paul. Based on Talmudic traditions, not normally taken into account by secular scholars, we'll offer tonight a somewhat different view of the sect of Qumran and their place in history. However, to fully understand the impact of these scrolls, I would like to begin with the ancient account of the mysterious sect of the Essenes. You should all have these handouts. Our information about the Essenes comes from three major sources. One is the Jewish philosopher Philo. He wrote in the first part of the first century of the Common Era. He was a very famous philosopher. He attempted to integrate Greek and Platonic philosophy with the Torah. And in two places in his writings, he describes at length the Essenes. In addition, Josephus, a Jewish historian, knew the Essenes intimately and describes them at great length. And finally, the Roman historian, naturalist Pliny the Elder briefly discusses the Essenes. The first source that we're going to discuss now is taken from Philo. Of course, as you see, there's a tremendous amount of information here. And Dr. Blumenkel keeps on telling me that I have to limit this. So we are only going to touch upon some of the ideas that from these original sources, and hopefully you'll take these home with you and you'll read them at length. In an essay that Philo writes, "Every good man is free," as he defines freedom, similar to the Talmudic dictum, "Ezehu ben choren, ein lecho ben choren ela mishoy sik v'Torah." A truly free man is one who involves himself in the study of Torah. Similarly, in a similar vein, Philo goes that true freedom is a person who devotes his life to a moral and spiritual life, and one can achieve true freedom. That's the thesis of his essay. And in this essay, he describes the Essenes. Palestinian Syria, on the first page, has not failed to produce high moral excellence. In this country live a considerable part of the very populous nation of the Jews, including, as it is said, certain persons, more than 4,000 in number, called Essenes. Philo goes on to theorize what the source of the meaning of the word of Essenes is, because it's not that clear. Philo theorizes that it comes from it's derived from a Greek word which means holiness, because they were holy people. Because they have, and this is underlined, because they have shown themselves especially devout in the service of God, not by offering sacrifices of animals, but by resolving to sanctify their minds. At this point, we see already a divergence from the mainstream of Judaism. They were not involved in the sacrificial service of the temple. He continues on, "The first thing about these people is they live in villages and avoid the cities because of the iniquities." According to this description, evidently they have divorced themselves from the mainstream life and live in the outlying areas. It's just interesting that the Aramaic word, which is found in various midrashim, of the word fields is asin. I don't know if that's the derivation, but it is very similar. "They make their livelihood by laboring on the land and pursue such crafts as cooperate with peace and so benefit themselves and their neighbors." He goes on to explain that they live very frugally, provide what is needed for the necessary requirements of life. "They don't produce weapons of war, nor are they involved." He says they have not the vaguest idea of commerce, either wholesale or retail. But they are involved in either living off the land or in peaceful crafts. Another area, it seems that they diverge with the mainstream of Jewry, at least at that time, is not a single slave is to be found among them, for all are free. They denounce the owner of slaves not merely for their injustice and outraging the law of equality, but also for their impiety in annulling the statute of nature. So philosophically, because based on their philosophical principles, they have, again, we had a divergence, at least of the mainstream Jewry at that time, they have no slaves. We find a similar dictum in the Talmud, in the Tractate Ovos, but there the basis is not about the horrors of slavery, but rather the preference of employing the Jewish poor. Evanim b'nei be'sefa. The poor should be those. You should employ Jewish poor rather than buying slaves. But here is a divergence that they're against the whole institution of slavery. It continues on, they're involved in philosophy, but not that part of philosophy which deals with logic, but rather that which deals with proving the existence of God and understanding the creation of the universe. And as well, they are involved in the ethical parts of philosophy as taught by the Torah. Shabbos is set aside for their studies, and here, interestingly, there's a whole hierarchy of page 2. They are arranged in rows according to their ages in the synagogue. Then one takes the books and reads aloud, and another of a special proficiency comes forward and expounds what is not understood. In the time of the Talmud, the time this was written, there was a practice of targum, of translating that which was read publicly of the Torah. In other words, just as we have public reading of the Torah, but after every sentence, after every verse, the mitargim, the translator, would get up and give the Aramaic translation, if it would be in the Aramaic-speaking lands. It seems, though, from Philo that this goes more than just being a mere translation. But really, what they did, they stopped, is really they expounded on the, as just the reading would say, that they expounded on. And here it continues on, for most of their philosophical study takes the form of allegory. And in this they emulate the tradition of the past. Philo's whole writings, that in the life of Moses, the studies of the book of creation, explains the Torah in Platonic and Greek terms and says that the vehicle is, the Torah is an allegory for these ideas. We don't find, though, a parallel in mainstream Judaism. As if we go through the Talmud and go through the Midrashim, we don't find at least a consistent idea of the Torah to be understood as an allegory. And it would seem from the reading of Philo that the one who got up and explained it explained the deeper meaning, the allegory that was meant in the verse, not merely a translation. He goes on, and I'm skipping, but he goes on that they are very careful to abstain from oaths. And again, we find in the Talmud of Wells as a parallel of the reluctance to make oaths. But what seems to really put them in a different class and truly label them as a sect is the last part, which you find on page 2, which is underlined, and their spirit of fellowship, which defies description. But first of all, no one's house is his own in the sense that is not shared by all. For besides the fact that they dwell together in communities, the door is open to visitors from elsewhere who share their convictions. Again, they all have a single treasury and common disbursements. Their clothes are held in common, and also their food through their institution of public meals. He goes on to say, for all the wages which they earn in the day's work, they do not keep as their private property, but throw them into the common stock and allow the benefit thus accruing to be shared by those who wish to use it. What they created was a communist commune. In other words, it was a... And he continues on that they help the elderly and the sick. One's reminded of Marx's dictum about each one takes according to their need, everyone attributes according to their ability. So let's just summarize what picture we have of the Essenes so far. Like, we'll describe what are these people. One, we say they don't offer sacrifices. They're not part of the mainstream. They avoid the cities. They live in villages. They live very frugally. They're not involved in war. They're not involved in commerce and only involved in peaceful pursuits. They denounce the institution of slavery. They're philosophers who delve into the existence of God, the creation of the universe, and the correct ethical principles of life. This seems to suggest that there is a certain hierarchy, at least in their seating arrangement. They explain the Torah with allegory. They abstain from oaths. And they live in an ideal communist community. At least that's the sense we have. These very different than anyone, at least that I know. At least I don't come to the coil. You know. We have another description of the Essenes in the works of Philo, taken from a different essay. The whole essay has not been preserved. It's just interesting to note, by the way, the one who preserved Philo was Eusebius, the church father. He was the bishop of Caesarea. He lived in the 3rd century. 4th century. He felt, and scholars have repudiated this, but he felt that Philo was actually describing early Christians. And that's why he really preserved him, because he felt he was that what was being described was primitive or early Christianity. But of course, scholars maintain by and large this is not the case. In one essay of Philo called The Hypothetica, which is the subtitle is, it's an apology, it's a defense of Judaism. All of it has not been preserved. However, there is a section here which has been preserved by Eusebius, and that's in the second paragraph here on page 2. Multitudes of his disciples has the lawgiver trained for the life of fellowship. It's not clear who this lawgiver is. These people are called Essenes. A name awards them doubtless in recognition of their holiness. Here he says they live in many cities of Judea and in many villages, which seems to be a departure of what he said originally, that they avoid the cities. Perhaps this is written at a different time of his life. It's not clear. Maybe they had changed. But what's significant is, and he goes on, it's underlined, thus no Essene is a mere child or even a stripling or newly bearded. Since the characters of such are unstable, with waywardness, corresponding to the immaturity of their age, but full-grown and verging on old age. In other words, they come as adults to this sect. Page 3 we have, he describes their work ethic. They labor with untiring application. And he goes on, as he described before, the fact is that there's an appointed treasurer, that all they make comes into the common, becomes the common monies of the commune. They have a common life, a common table. But he finishes off, which is a point which he had not made before. And he says, no Essene takes a wife. And he speaks of women in the most terrible terms. Not taken from Jewish tradition, perhaps, and I'm not aware of this, but perhaps it does come from certain sections of Greek tradition. those who went. But if you, it's not. I have no the time nor the interest of quoting what he says here. But but after, it's just interesting, after he describes this, that why they have, the Essenes are celibate. But he just, it's interesting, he finishes off, such then is the life of the Essenes, a life so highly to be prized that not only commoners, but also great kings look upon them with admiration and amazement. And the approbation and honors which they give add further veneration to their venerable name. Josephus describes that they were held in high esteem by Herod, which doesn't tell you too much about the Essenes. The next source we have, and we're going to go through this just very briefly, even though it has there's many, many pages, but I would like, again, I'd like you to take this home with you and like to read this on your own, is the account of the Essenes given by Josephus. Josephus knew them intimately. And he describes how when he was a young man, he tried. He went to the Sadducees. This were the, would be the equivalent of secular Jews. I mean, outwardly, they observed religious observances, but actually they were very secular in their outlook. Of the Pharisees, which were the mainstream of Jewry, and the Essenes. So that which he writes of them is not from merely hearsay, because when we have the writings of Philo, we're never sure if he really ever saw an Essene. It just, he lived in Alexandria, so it's not sure if he ever intimately knew them or just merely from hearsay. And of course, when it's hearsay, there's the chance of distortion. Josephus describes, and there are certain points that Philo makes that are not echoed in Josephus, but he doesn't contradict really anything that Philo says. The Essenes reject pleasure as an evil. This is. So here we have just another step of understanding them. It isn't that they're merely frugal, but they look at pleasure itself as an evil. They neglect wedlock. But he says an interesting point, and choose out other persons' children while they are pliable and fit for learning, and esteem them to be of their kindred and form them according to their own manners. Now, as it seems, even though if we mesh Philo and Josephus together, the Essenes were adults, but they did teach younger people and train them for a life in that sect. Like they were. Again, I can only just touch on a few points here. But one thing, an interesting point that he makes, and it's the top of page 5, they also think, this is being a good thing, to be clothed in white garments. They're generally clothed in white. There's an interesting parallel in the Talmud. There's a Mishnah in Megillah, in Chof Dalet Amud Beis, in 24b, describes as a person who would rather, when he's called to be the shliach tzibur, the chazan, the one to officiate, he'd rather be dressed in white, as would prefer being dressed in white to carry on the position of the chazan. He says, even if you dissuade him and he agrees to wear something which is colored, don't take him up. There's something wrong with him. And the Talmud explains, Shema Nizruko boy minus. Perhaps heresy has infected him. Which it would seem to be a parallel here. And we're going to dwell on this a little later on, but it seems that the mainstream of Jewry looked at these Essenes as heretics. He goes on to describe many of the things we've heard in Philo already, but in the middle of the page 5, before sun rising, they speak not a word about profane matters, but put up certain prayers which they have received from their forefathers. We know, again, there's a parallel in the Talmud. This is Vasikin. This is the those that are very careful in the practice of halacha make it a point to daven as the sun rises. So here's something he describes in the scenes. We have a parallel in normative Judaism. But after they daven, they go to work with great diligence till the fifth hour, which again has a parallel in the Talmud. The Talmud teaches us, as a Gemara in Shabbos, in 10a, Yud Amud Aleph, that the workers stopped working on the fifth hour, took a break to eat, which is representative of it. But they assemble together in one place, and when they have clothed themselves in white veils, then they bathe their bodies in cold water. This is unprecedented. And it seems that they didn't bathe normally. They always made sure to cover themselves up before they bathe. After this purification is over, then everyone meets together in an apartment of their own, into which it is not permitted to any other sect to enter. In other words, none of the Pharisees, the mainstream Jews, none of the Sadducees. While they go after a pure manner into the dining room as into a certain holy temple, and quietly set themselves down, upon which the baker lays them loaves in order. The cook also brings a single plate of one sort of food and sets it before every one of them. But a priest says grace before meat, which is interesting. There's no parallel, unless there's a mistranslation from the Latin or from the Latin into the Greek of Josephus. Perhaps he means the meal. As in lawful for anyone to taste the food before grace be said. The same priest, when they have finished dining, says grace again after the meal. Again, there is an interesting parallel, also a normative halacha, that everything else being equal, one honors the priest, the Kohen. That's why the custom is, when one is saying the grace after meal in public, they say Birshus HaKohanim, as you say, with the permission of the Kohanim, because they really should go first. So again, there is a parallel. But as they go, as he continues on, they finish the meal, they go to their labors again, they put aside their special garments, and they come back again after work is done for supper. This is something very peculiar with these people is they make sure that no one talks without first being called upon, as everyone has their turn to talk, which silence thus kept in their house appears to foreigners like some tremendous mystery. Seems to be very regimented. If you see 3 lines from the bottom, it says everything they do is according to the injunctions of their curators. Because there are masters, so to speak, curators that take care of everything that happens in this commune. On page 6, we find which gives us a little more of an inkling of what these people are. It says, they take great pains in studying the writings of the ancients, and it's not clear which writings, and choose out of them what is most for the advantage of their soul and body. They inquire after such roots and medicinal stones as may cure their distempers. And now he goes on to describe how one becomes an Essene. I don't know if anyone here, after hearing the original part, has had. First of all, there's a trial period for 1 year. He is given, and they observe the person during the year. After this, they give him after the first year, they give him tentative admission, which is another 2 year trial period. And before he is allowed to touch their common food, he is obliged to take tremendous oaths, and this is really the oaths to enter this commune, this sect. I have underlined one of the things that they swear on is they will always hate the wicked. It's not clear who the wicked are. It can maybe get a little clearer as we go on tonight. Another one is, nor discover any of their doctrines to others. They evidently have secret doctrines. It would seem Josephus, who never became an Essene, really was not aware of those secret doctrines. He just knew of their existence. And though that anyone should compel him so to do at the hazard of his life. And he will equally preserve the books belonging to their sect. Evidently, the sect has special books, unique to the sect. And the names of the angels. So here we have in Josephus the idea already of the initiation, the mysteries of the sect. And because these people made these oaths, and the oaths include not only divulging of information, but also that they have certain levels of purity in terms of how they eat. And really, the eating is organized and regulated by the members of the sect. So if someone is found guilty of violating the rules of the sect and is thrown out and can't eat their food, he has a hard time eating. And Josephus goes on to say that many of them die of hunger. Those who have been cast out of the sect feel still compelled to uphold the oath. And sometimes just the mere compassion, they're taken back. So let's just pause a second here. Again, before we continue on, and then we'll finish soon the writings of Josephus. We have a very strange group of people over here. I don't know if anyone got the message already. But besides the fact, again, we have the idea that the celibacy, the communal living, mysterious doctrines, these terrible oaths, we have the idea of this hatred for the wicked. And again, there's something, who are their enemies? On page 7, we have another facet, which we touched upon briefly in the second work of Philo. This is on the third line. What they most of all honor after God himself is the name of the legislator, whom if anyone blasphemes, he is punished capitally. In the Latin translation, there's a parenthesis of legislator, and they have Moses. But it doesn't seem to be in all the texts
That's the new version.
Is this legislator someone different than Moses? Just turn back in the second quote we have from Philo on page 2. This is paragraph B. Multitudes of his disciple has the lawgiver trained for the life of fellowship. This lawgiver is not Moses. Evidently, there's a special legislator, lawgiver, that created the sect of the Essenes. Neither Philo nor Josephus names him. An interesting parallel, though, in the writings of, we briefly mentioned the name of Pliny the Elder. He was a Roman historian, naturalist. His nephew was called Pliny the Younger. And Pliny the Younger, amongst the things he did in life, he was a governor in Bithynia. It's an area in Turkey, on the southern shore of the Black Sea. And he had a constant, his letters have been preserved, this Pliny the Younger's, and there's a letter here to Trajan the Emperor about the Christians. And to blot out what he looks as the Christian heresy. And how he, if a person is suspected of being a Christian, how they prove it is they ask him to blaspheme the founder of Christianity. And if they refuse, it's an indication that the person is a Christian. So blaspheming, it seems, there is a parallel here. And it's something, again, we're going to go back to later on in the lecture. On page 7, in the second paragraph, towards the bottom of the paragraph, there's another also interesting bit of evidence which also parallels what happened to Christians. And we do not have a very strong parallel amongst Jews in that era. I'll start a little before the thing that's underlined. But as for death, if it will be for their glory, they esteem it better than living always. And indeed, our war with the Romans gave abundant evidence. This is in the year 66 to 70. What great souls they had in their trials, wherein, although they were tortured and distorted, burnt and torn to pieces, and went through all kinds of instruments of torment, and be forced either to blaspheme their legislator, or to eat what is forbidden them, as uniquely as it seems, yet they could not be made to do either of them. No, nor once to flatter their tormentors or to shed a tear, but they smiled in their very pain and laughed those to scorn who inflicted the torments upon them, resigned up their souls with great alacrity as expecting to receive them again. Again, it seems an interesting parallel that the Romans were concerned that they blasphemed their legislator. Why? It seems the Romans looked at them different than what seemed to be mainstream Jews. What did they believe in, these Essenes? What was their belief system? We know about, they must have secret doctrines. But what was those beliefs that at least we were aware of that was different than mainstream Jewry? Josephus describes at length in different sections of his work about the fact that the Essenes believed in life after death. But from the way he describes it, it seems the Essenes did not believe in the notion of the resurrection at the end of history. And this is that which was part of the mainstream belief is the idea of Tchias HaMesim, that at the end of history, after the time of the advent of Mashiach, of the Messiah, when history as we know it has come to an end, all those, or at least the righteous of those who have lived previous in this life, are resurrected, come back again. Josephus quotes this as a belief of the Pharisees, but when he describes the beliefs of the afterlife and the Essenes, he doesn't mention it at all. He looks at the, as it says at the end, on the last paragraph on page 7, the bodies are corruptible, and that the matter they are made of is not permanent, but the souls are immortal. And he goes on to the immortality of the soul, which is also a belief of the Pharisees. But he makes no mention of that belief of resurrection. Another unique thing about the Essenes, which would seem again to put them, have a different course than mainstream Jewry, is in the second paragraph on page 8. There are also those among them who undertake to foretell things to come by reading the holy books and using several sorts of purification, being perpetual conversant in the discourses of the prophets. It's but seldom that they miss in their prediction. They're involved in the psychic activity. And it's, again, something that at least in the time of the Talmud, which is unheard of, as an involvement. And it's something Josephus describes in more than one place about the ability of the leaders of the Essenes to make these predictions. Now just lastly, and then we'll go on, another belief that seems to put them at odds with mainstream Jewry is the idea of predetermination. Josephus describes the beliefs, again, the three sects, the Sadducees, the secular Jews, who believe that God really doesn't take an interest or involvement in one's individual life. They also did not believe in an afterlife, the Sadducees. And man makes all decisions. The Essenes, on the other hand, and this is on page 9 in paragraph F, it's underlined, but the sect of the Essenes affirms that fate governs all things and nothing befalls men but what is according to its determination. And then he says, the Pharisees have the middle ground that God controls much, but we have free will. Makes a point in describing the basis of the beliefs of Jews. The Rambam says this in Hilchos Tshuva, in the Laws of Repentance. The idea of free will is probably one of the most central doctrines of Judaism. You can remake yourself. But there's an area that God does not control, that you control. There's a Gemara in Nida, in Tezainim and Beis, in 16b, describes that before a person is formed, God tells the angel what path this person's life is going to take. Is it going to be rich or poor, intelligent or not intelligent, strong or weak? But is he going to be a saintly person or a wicked person is not determined. Every individual has to determine that. That's, I guess, traditionally is the area that we determine. It would seem if the Essenes take issue with that, it seems that they take a position that even who is the elect, in other words, who are the saintly, is something which is predetermined. There are parallels to that belief in antiquity, amongst the early Protestant leaders, under Luther and Calvin, in Islam, but it's not a mainstream Jewish idea. I hope after this, and we've spent a considerable time on this, but just to give you a sense of what these people are, you have an inkling of the difference between the Essenes and mainstream Jews. But one thing that seems to unite both Philo and Josephus, besides most of it's corroborated, but one is the fact that they live all over. Originally Philo says just in the villages, and the second one he says the villages and the cities. Josephus makes the point that they live all over in all the cities. Our final citation about the Essenes is taken from Pliny, his work on natural history. We're going to quote that. Pliny the Elder died when Mount Vesuvius, the cities of Pompeii and Herculium were destroyed by the eruption of Vesuvius. So it's not clear when he wrote this. I mean, it was before the year was 79, before the 79 of the Common Era, at the when he died. But he describes on the west side of the Dead Sea, away from the coast, where there are harmful vapors, or influence is not clear, the interpreters here, lives the solitary tribe of the Essenes. Here he puts them in a specific place, not in every city, not all over, but on the west side of the Dead Sea. This tribe is remarkable beyond all others in the whole world because it has no women, has rejected sexual desires without money, has only the company of palm trees. Day by day, the crowd of refugees is renewed by hordes of people tired of life and driven there by the waves of fortune to adopt their customs. Again, it's not, in all probability, Pliny never saw them, and again, just like much of what he writes in Natural in this work is of hearsay. But he describes them as desperate people. But thus, through thousands of ages, and again, he wasn't, according at least to Josephus, their relatively new sect, but he poetically describes it, incredible to relate, the race in which no one is born lives forever. So fruitful of them is other men's dissatisfaction with life, as they keep on getting new recruits. Below the Essenes was the town of En Gedi, second only to Jerusalem in the fertility of its soil, its groves of palm trees, but now, like Jerusalem, another heap of ashes. So he wrote this evidently at least after the destruction of the temple in the year 70. Then comes Masada, fortress on a rock not far from the Dead Sea. This is the extent of Judea. He places the place of the Essenes, it would seem, where this place of Qumran is. And it's this quote of Pliny that confirmed the notion that these writings and what seems to be a monastery that they found in this Qumran was actually the place described by Pliny. But one again has to wonder, it seems that they were all over from Josephus and Philo. What are they doing specifically on the Dead Sea? As we related before, there was much literature that was discovered in the caves near the Dead Sea. This was not the first time that discoveries were made in that area. One of the early church fathers by the name of Origen, in the early third century of the Common Era, put together what is known as the Hexapla, which were six versions, Hebrew and Greek, of the Bible. And in one of the versions he has from Psalms, He says this was taken from a cave near the Dead Sea. And a later, one of the later writers, Jerome, two centuries later, writes that it was taken in the reign of Caracalla, which was in the year probably 220 of the Common Era. So evidently things were found all the way back then by the Dead Sea. Here on page 10 we have another finding by the Dead Sea. This was taken from a letter from an historian patriarch of he's the patriarch, like the equivalent of the Pope, and he's writing to a metropolitan, which is equivalent of a bishop. Nestorians were another sect of early Christians. This is, we have learned from trustworthy Jews, I mean, they continue on, I think, even to this date, they're still, but it's not, doesn't have the numbers of the Catholics or the Orthodox. We learned from trustworthy Jews that some books were found 10 years ago in a rock dwelling near Jericho. That story was that the dog of an Arab out hunting went into a cave in pursuit of game, not come out again. Its owner went in after it and found a chamber in a rock in which there were many books. The hunter went off to Jerusalem and told the story to the Jews, who came out in great numbers and found books of the Old Testament and others in the Hebrew script. It seems, at least historians, that the findings around that time were the origin of a document which dates from the early Middle Ages. I mean, which is known as the Damascus Covenant. In the attic of a shul, of a synagogue in Egypt, in old Cairo, there's the Ben Ezra Synagogue. And its geniza, in its storage place, held documents for hundreds and hundreds of years. We have from the response of the Gaonim, we find have been preserved in that geniza. Solomon Schechter, who was working in Cambridge in England, originally took it back with him. He started working on it in 1895. This is really where he developed his fame, is from this Cairo geniza. And here we're going to quote at least some of a document that was found very different than standard rabbinic texts. And it seems to be something which was found during that period of time that's described by this historian patriarch, and subsequently in the writings of Qumran that we have today, they were rediscovered, so to speak. At least parts. I mean, there were fragments, but parts of this work were discovered in those Qumran caves, together with all the other literature. On paragraph B, in the second paragraph, "For when they were unfaithful and forsook him, he hid his face from Israel and his sanctuary, and delivered them up to the sword. But remembering the covenant of the forefathers, he left a remnant to Israel, did not deliver it up to be destroyed. And in the age of wrath, 390 years after he had given them into the hand of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon," there's a question, this is a real number, a symbolic number, "he visited them and he caused a plant root to spring from Israel and Aaron to inherit his land and to prosper on good things of his earth." Which seems to be, the scholars, that this is referring to the success of the Maccabees. "And they perceived their iniquity and recognized that they were guilty men. Yet for 20 years they were like blind men groping for the way, and God observed their deeds, that they sought him with a whole heart, and he raised for them a teacher of righteousness to guide them in the way of his heart. And he made it known to later generations that which God had done to the latter generation, the congregation of traitors, not clear who these traitors are, to those who departed from the way. This was the time of which it is written, like a stubborn heifer, thus was Israel stubborn. When the scoffer arose, or the man of lies arose, who shed over Israel the water of lies, he caused them to wander in a pathless wilderness. As before, we have a teacher of wanderness. This is now contrasted with the scoffer who rises and is leading them again towards the path of lies, laying low the everlasting heights, abolishing the ways of righteousness, and removing the boundary which the forefathers had marked out their inheritance, that he may call down on them the curses of his covenant, and deliver them up to the avenging sword of the covenant. In other words, it seems that what they're writing of is there was a time that without direction came this teacher of righteousness. This teacher of righteousness was challenged by this liar, this scoffer. Who was this liar and scoffer? We're going to see soon. For they sought smooth things. The language in the text is dorshe halokos, which is similar to, interesting, dorshe halokos. And some say, scholars, it's a play on words. The dorshe halokos, or the halokos, are referring to the Pharisees. And it seems the Pharisees are their enemies. These are the rabbis. And preferred illusions and watched for breaks. The pirzos, which is the word used, and we know that the watchword for the Pharisees, we find from the tradition that's recorded in Ovos, says, asusiogla Torah, make a fence around the Torah. This is rabbinic legislation to protect from these breaches in conduct. And it seems this was criticized, and these people were criticized by the authors of this document. And he finishes off on this page, and the anger of God was kindled against their congregation. This is the Pharisees, what seems the Dorshe Chaloka. So he ravaged all their multitude, and their deeds were defilement before him. We're soon going to see in which way were they ravaged, which way was the wrath kindled. And on top of page 11, here we have already a sense of who the enemy was. Who were the people that were writing this document? How do they describe themselves? And you should know that the term Essene is never found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. This was a term that others called them. They called themselves B'nai Tzadok. The priests, the Levites, the sons of Tzadok, and this is taken from a verse in Ezekiel, who kept the charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel strayed from me, they shall offer me fat and blood. The simple meaning is that there were priests who strayed away. There was of the priestly family, Tzadok, it's well known. They kept the tradition. They will be privileged to be the ones who will offer the sacrifices again. Their interpretation here, which is common to much of the interpretation found in the Qumran documents, is not the simple meaning, but rather the priests are the converts of Israel who departed from the land of Judah. It seems that those are those who went in exile before the pressures, in other words, of these Dorshe Chalokos, the seekers of smooth things. The Levites, those who joined them, the word Levaya is connection, so Levi is connection. And the sons of Tzadok are the elect of Israel, the men called by name who shall stand at the end of the days. And again, we have the idea of the elect, you know, the tzaddikim who are born tzaddikim. And they seem to be called themselves the B'nai Tzadok, which is a little interesting, and we're going to go back to this soon. The Sadducees are called the Tzedukim. According to rabbinic tradition, recorded in Ovis to Rabbi Nosson, the Tzedukim, their name is taken by a disciple of Antigonus, Ish Socho, the man of Socho. And this Tzedek was the founder of a sect that denied the afterlife. And that was the basis, according to rabbinic tradition, of the Tzedukim, those who denied an afterlife. These B'nai Tzedek, which would seem to be the Essenes, very much believe in an afterlife. It's funny why they should call themselves the same name. And this is something we're going to get back to. And this is a source of much confusion among scholars. Who are these? Are these the same as the Sadducees? Seems to be the same name, but the beliefs are totally in opposition. Much of the literature that we have extant of how they live their life is parallel to the accounts of the Essenes that we have in Philo and Josephus. And that's why the majority of scholars dealing with the Dead Sea Scrolls maintain that the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls were either Essenes, the mainline Essenes, or an offshoot of them. But they were part of the general movement of Essenes. We discussed before about secret doctrines we were not aware of, just alluded to. But we do find in the writings of Qumran a halachic system, much different than normative Judaism. And I'm just going to touch upon this. First, the calendar. You know, it's on page 11, section 3. The calendar was a fixed calendar of 364 days. The first day of the month of Nisan started on a Wednesday. And that's how it is every year. Every day is calculated. There's a question in scholars that what is not clear is if it's a 364 day year, what do we do with the 1 1/4 days that keep on the change? So the after accumulation will be totally, it seems still from the Torah that there is a relationship to the seasons. And there must be some means of intercalculation, but we don't have the documentation. There's one theory that every 35 years, every 28 years, 35 days are added, which is the difference. And that would, if you do that, things would go back. But again, it's only a theory. But it's clearly a different calendar. The traditional calendar is basically a lunar calendar and starts with the beginning of the sighting of the new moon. An extra month is added, of course, approximately every 3 years. This is this year as well, that the solar calendar and the lunar calendar should be in sync. But this was a fixed calendar. Very different. If one would be a faithful member of the sect of Qumran, one could not really observe the Torah in a normative way. Another departure, which is alluded to in the Talmud, referring to the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, again, these secularized Jews, was about the preparation of the red heifer, the Porah Adumah. The red heifer which is slaughtered and burned, and his ashes, which is mixed with fresh spring water, is used in the cleansing process of those who've come in contact with a dead body. The Kohen who processes this red heifer is someone, according to Halacha, that has gone to the mikveh, but not necessarily has undergone the complete process of purification which is, happens at the setting of the sun. There's normally, if someone had come in contact with something which is impure, he goes to the mikveh, could not enter the temple normally unless the sun set. So even though he's quasi, in other words, pure, the rabbinic tradition is he can still process the Porah Adumah, the red heifer. And the rabbis made a point, since the Sadducees disagreed with them, and said no, that the Kohen has to wait until the sun sets. It isn't enough that he goes to the mikveh and is ritually pure, but he has to wait till sunset. There is an elaborate system to make sure, A, that the Kohen who does this before the sun sets, because the Sadducees seem to hold an opposite view. And second of all, because they're taking this liberty here about the purification of this Kohen, there are elaborate chumras on the other way, and the stringencies of how he should, in terms of his status, of purity, that to make sure that the only thing he's, you know, is the problem, the sun setting, but otherwise he's totally pure. In the documentation we have from the Qumran sect is that they were careful to make sure the sun set. Again, time doesn't allow. You can look through the pages. You'll see that there are various, and I just took some of them, there are various areas where there is real difference. According to regular normative law, one is allowed to marry a niece. According to the law of the Qumran community, which is the sect of the Dead Sea Scrolls, one is not. It's an act of, it goes under the laws of incest. Again, let's just briefly again, we've covered an enormous amount of information here. Let's just stop at this point before we go on to the next section here. We've described the sect in the Essenes at great length. It seems what we have extant, we have from the documentation of the sect in Qumran, their life seems to be very similar to that of the Essenes. We've seen in last readings various areas that they are at odds with the rabbinic establishment. Not only they are at odds at practice, but we saw from the Damascus document that they really are at odds with them in terms of they treat them as their enemy. They feel persecuted by them. And they seem to rejoice that they seem to have had this this tragedy that they feel befell the Pharisees, their enemies, because they had persecuted them. There's a document that was uncovered that's recently been published that we have, it seems, from the leader of the sect, and some think that it's from this teacher of righteousness himself, that writes to the establishment in the temple to, it seems, to get their position back. And it's on page 14, so it's titled The Schism. So now you know that we separated from the mainstream of the people and refuse to mix or go along with them on these matters. Again, after describing, and we've quoted from some of this, the areas that they disagree with we call the mainstream establishment. You also know that no rebelling or lying or evil shall be found in his temple. In other words, It is because of these things we present these words and wrote to you, that you shall discern the book of Moses and the words of the prophets and David. And he goes on about the blessings and the curse, and he seems to want to persuade the leader in Jerusalem that this leader should accept their way rather than the mainstream way. We don't have the title. We don't know who is the one who sent it, even though we could perhaps theorize it's the leader of the group. We don't know to whom it was sent, but it would seem to be someone that potentially would have certain sympathies with these scenes. Even though, again, we don't have. But we do have, even though we don't know to whom it is written, we do happen to have certain documentation of the people that were held in high esteem by the Essenes and those that were not. One of them is the king by the name of Yoinason, which seems to be equivalent to Alexander Yanai, who was a Sadducee. Early in his reign, he and his father before him tried to stamp out rabbinic Judaism. And it's interesting to note that there is a sacred poem, you see on page 14 on the bottom, for King Jonathan and all the congregation of your people Israel. He evidently seemed to be held in high esteem. On page 15, we have Demetrius, the king of Greece. This mentioned that at the instance of that sought smooth things, Demetrius was the king, was a Greek king, was a Greek, but who was the king of the Syrians at Damascus. At the behest, it seems, of the Pharisees, who are called now Dorshe Halokos, who said, again, those who seek smooth things, he was asked to fight against Yanai, the Sadducee, who was persecuting the Pharisees. The young lion of anger wrought vengeance on them. He was successful. It's described in at great length in Josephus. 2 years ago, we devoted a class to this. Those that smart soothed things, and he proceeded to hang them up alive. After he'd won the battle, he took 800 of his enemies of the Sadducees and he had them crucified. And he had their wives and children, their throats slit while they were hanging on the cross. This incident seems to be partially alluded to in their writings. Evidently they were pro-Yanai, pro-Sadducee. There's just a slight fragment about Shlomtza, Salome, Shalom Tzion, who eventually sided with the Pharisees, and when her husband died, she actually gave over the whole kingdom to the Pharisees, as you see here in the 7th page 15. Eventually, after she died, there was a civil war between her son Hyrcanus, who it seems was also used by the Pharisees and was on good terms with the Pharisees, and his brother Aristobulus. And in the midst of the civil war, the Romans were brought in. Pompey, the Roman general consul, Palestine, Judea became a Roman province, became under the Romans, and under a Roman governor by the name of Aemilius Scaurus, that again his name is mentioned here in the fragments. There's before I went, this is my theory of who this teacher of righteousness was and what these events were when the sect arose, I would like on page 16, and just briefly, we have what we have extant of from the Qumran writings about this teacher of righteousness. Part of the writings are what is known as a form of commentary known as Pesher. And here he describes describing the book of Habakkuk, this particular one, describes the events described in the prophet in terms of the life of the sect and the dynamics between the teacher of righteousness and, again, the wicked priest. You can read this. The wicked priest, in the same paragraph B, the man of the lie, which was alluded to before in the Damascus covenant. A person Avshalom, in paragraph C, is alluded to. The house of Avshalom and the men of their party were faithless men who kept silent at the chastisement of the teacher of righteousness and did not help him against the man of the lie who rejected the law in the midst of the congregation. We know of an Avshalom who was the father-in-law of this Aristobulus. This is the Aristobulus and Hyrcanus of the Civil War. Aristobulus was a Sadducee. Avshalom, it would seem, was a Sadducee. It would seem that they looked for help by the Sadducees, and the help did not come. Again, we don't know clearly who the priest is, who the man of the lie is. But it seems from the literature that this all happened around the time of the king Yanai and this Demetrius, the king of Greece of Damascus, the Greeks in Damascus, while the Pharisees were fighting Yanai and the Sadducees. So we have a period of time of the fight of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. In the middle of this, we have this mysterious teacher of righteousness who seems to be the founder of this sect. Up until now are facts that you will read in any text about the Dead Sea Scrolls. From this time point on, I would like just to offer my own theory, and then I will take questions. There's another person that's not mentioned by name, but according to the tradition of the Talmud, he was the most powerful man of the time. So on page 15, in paragraph E, that's Shimon ben Shetach. Shimon ben Shetach was the brother-in-law of Yanai, the Sadducee king of Israel. His sister was Shalom Tzion, the one who had the great feelings towards the Pharisees, and eventually when her husband died, she let the Pharisees control the country. I have quoted here, I'm not going to quote this verbatim, but we have recorded that there was a time that even though originally that Yanai acted to destroy the rabbinic establishment, eventually Shimon ben Shetach, the brother-in-law of Shalom Tzion, the greatest scholar of his time, eventually took over the Sanhedrin, displaced the members of the Sadducees who were in control. And it seems, to the extent that he could, having a brother-in-law like Yanai, he brought life back to what had been before the Sadducees took control. That's one person which is mentioned at length in the Talmud. There's another person mentioned at length in the Talmud. On page 17, and I did not translate this. You'll have to take my word for this. There is much of the Talmud that has been censored. There are several sections of the Talmud that have been censored. And those that deal with a person by the name of Yeshu. The Catholic Church maintained that this Yeshu was the founder of Christianity. And as a result, at one time, several attempts burned the Talmud, any of the volumes of the Talmud they could get their hands on. And eventually, when they allowed the Talmud to be reprinted, made sure that those sections that had any reference to this Yeshu were deleted. In the original version that we have, this Yeshu is a disciple of Yeshua ben Prachya. Yeshua ben Prachya was the teacher of Shimon ben Shetach. Shimon ben Shetach, after the Sadducees had taken over Israel, it seems when Shimon ben Shetach, being the brother-in-law of the king, used his influence, was able to bring this Yeshua ben Prachya back. And this Yeshua ben Prachya, Shimon ben Shetach's teacher, had a disciple with him. That disciple, He was a person that, because of things that he saw on the trip back, Yeshua ben Prachya, he distanced himself from him, put that disciple in excommunication. That disciple went on, as the description is, to cast Jews, lead Jews astray. And he was eventually killed by the Sanhedrin because he led Jews astray to idolatry and he practiced witchcraft. Because of the Sima, and the name is preserved is Yeshu, this disciple. He was a contemporary of Shimon ben Shetach. He is referred to in several places of the Talmud. It seems from Rashi that his name is associated with Min, which is the heretic. And there's an interesting statement that when the Sanhedrin put Yeshu to death, they gave him an honor that they afforded no other. 40 days before his execution, they normally, after the person is tried, he's executed. 40 days before his execution, there was announcements were made that anyone who could come to his defense should come to his defense. And the reason they made this exception for him because he was close to members of government. And they couldn't just go and kill him. My theory, this last few minutes of the class, is that the teacher of righteousness, that person whose name was preserved in the Talmud, that they looked as the arch enemy of the Pharisees and the founder of these heretics, was not Jesus of Nazareth, but rather the founder of these Essenes. The secret doctrines that referred to was about his divinity. And that's why they were so careful that his name should never be blasphemed. And that's why the Romans in turn wanted to torture them that they should blaspheme their legislator, which according to my theory is this Yeshu HaNotzri, or Yeshu, not the one who was a contemporary of Pontius Pilate, but rather one who was a contemporary of Shimon ben Shetach. before Shimon ben Shetach was able to exert real influence, when the Sadducees still had influence, he created his sect, called them by the same name as the Sadducees, B'nai Tzadok, not for their reason, but because of the similarity of the name and the feeling through that he would able to exert influence over them. And it could very well be, while Shimon ben Shetach was able to exert such influence after he was, they were forced to run. And that's why they were so happy when the Pharisees were finally defeated by Yannai, and their members were crucified. Eventually, Hyrcanus, the son of Yannai, who was originally a Sadducee, and perhaps an ally of this Yeshu, went over to the Pharisees when his father died, when openly rabbinic law was in force. And as we quote here on page 15, so she made Hyrcanus high priest because he was elder, and much more because he cared not to meddle with politics, and permitted the Pharisees to do everything, to whom she also ordered the multitude to be obedient. She also restored again those practices which the Pharisees had introduced, according to the traditions of their forefathers. At that point, these Essenes, the teacher of righteousness, was hunted down, and eventually he was killed. He had many friends close to government and the original Sadducees. The Sadducees held him in great regard, because at that point the Pharisees had achieved ascendancy. They were not able to resist. And that's why they held the Pharisees in such, in their literature, with such contempt. It could very well be that the question of where they lived in all cities, or where they were in a remote place on the Dead Sea, was dependent on their on the politics of whether the Pharisees were in ascendancy or not. Where the Pharisees had control, they had to be much more of a clandestine organization. And that's where eventually their main headquarters was, on the Dead Sea, as Pliny describes. What comes out just oddly then is much of the censorship and destruction and persecution of Jews was a question of mistaken identity. And perhaps then much of what's discussed in the Talmud is not really dealing with Christianity, but perhaps a forerunner of Christianity that occurred 100 years before. 2 weeks from now, we will go into the life and times of Josephus Flavius, the historian.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.